you know, this talk is in, it's in a, not the same session as Kurt's and Rob's, but in a way it's in the same spirit as their talks. We're all kind of the same vintage. And, you know, we've been around a while, we've accumulated a fair amount of artillery, and we're sort of maybe casting around looking for interesting things to attack with our artillery. And so I think this talk is in that spirit. So, I mean, the name of the title of the talk doesn't suggest that, but what motivated me to look at this problem was a problem in what's called environmetrics, which is environmental monitoring. And so I'll tell you about the particular problem in environmental monitoring that I was looking at, but for the last 20 years I've kind of been playing with this problem and trying to bring in a variety of techniques to apply to it. And the interesting thing is, you know, before I started working on this, these problems still existed, and the kind of methods that people were using were local search and greedy methods, kind of the most naive discrete optimization methods possible. And I've been looking at this for 20 years, and you'll see my conclusion is basically local search is pretty good. So that's been my impact on the subject over a 20-year period. I'm very proud of it, actually. So anyway, let's get into what this is all about. So this is roughly what I'm going to do. I'm going to define what a submodular function is, because the particular function that's important in this environmental monitoring context is a submodular function. So I'll show you some examples of them and talk about the specific motivating problem, which is called maximum entropy sampling. And there are heuristics for this problem, like local search. And there's the maybe somewhat principled math programming approach to these problems. And that's what I'll talk about quite a bit. But then I'll talk about another approach to these problems, which is a theoretical computer science approach, where you really try to prove something about simple algorithms often for these kinds of problems. So that's the general scheme. Hopefully I'll get through even the last topic. So what's a submodular function? A submodular function is defined on a finite ground set called N here. And 2 to the N denotes the set of all subsets of N. So a function from subsets of N to the reals is submodular if it satisfies that simple inequality that F on the union plus F on the intersection is less than or equal to the sum of the F's on the individual sets for every pair of sets in the ground set. That isn't so intuitive to everybody, even though it sort of looks like a discrete kind of convexity. This kind of definition here seems to have more of an intuitive feel to it. And it's that these functions have decreasing marginal values or non-increasing marginal values. So if I look at two sets X and Y, X is a subset of Y, and I look at the increment of the function throwing in another element from the ground set, that the increase in the function on the smaller set is at least as big as the increase in the function on the larger set. So it's decreasing marginal values is a nice intuitive way to think about it, but I think every time I actually use submodularity, I use it in this form up here. For me, that's an easier way to directly get at what I need. So there's lots of different types of submodular functions. Some of the things that we prove depend on functions being monotone, so that just means non-decreasing on sets. Symmetric, I'll show you an example of a nice symmetric submodular function you probably know. Non-negative, when you want to prove approximation ratios, you need something like that. And just general submodular functions we'll talk about quite a bit. So examples of submodular functions are coverage functions, which are important in set covering, set packing, these kinds of situations. So you have an underlying finite universe U, and the ground set corresponds to elements in the ground set correspond to subsets of the universal set. And so I'm trying to still pick a group of elements from the ground set. That means pick from the finite set of subsets from the universal set. And what I'm interested in playing with optimizing is the number of elements covered. So that's what's written there, just the number of elements covered. And this is a nice monotone, non-negative submodular function. And you might think about trying to maximize this with a constraint on maybe how many sets you pick. Or maybe you're trying to minimize this covering a certain number of elements. That might be another kind of optimization problem that makes sense. Cut functions on graphs. You can think about a directed or an undirected graph. And maybe you have, well, here it's not written with weights, but you, if you just count the number of edges leaving a subset of the vertices, that's a submodular function, so it's an easy homework exercise. In fact, I think I assigned it last week. So this is a nice non-negative submodular function, and even if you had a weighted graph with non-negative weights, and for an undirected graph, it's a symmetric submodular function. But for a directed graph, then there's no reason to think about it. That would be symmetric. Matroids is a great example for me. I was thinking, you know, as I get older, I was thinking that fewer and fewer people know what matroids are. So I'm just curious, how many people in the audience have written a paper with the word matroid in it? I know, see, there's a lot of you. Where's Rob? Is he asleep yet? Come on, you must have. Come on, simplicial complex. Yeah, come on. Maybe, you're not sure. Yeah, so we wrote a paper together on matroids, but yeah, as I'll say, I wrote all the words matroid into the paper. That's true. Anyway, I'll, near the end of the talk, just to wake you up, I'll remind you what a matroid is. But for those who know, the rank function of a matroid is a submodular function. And if you take two matroids on the same ground set, and so they have different rank functions, R1 and R2, if you look at this combination of the rank functions, then minimizing this submodular function corresponds to finding a maximum, it's the dual of finding a maximum weight set or size set that's independent of the two matroids. So minimizing this kind of submodular function is solving this classical matroid intersection problem, which is a generalization of the assignment problem. So that's a nice example of a submodular function which is related to something classical in discrete optimization. And finally, the thing that really motivated me to look at submodular functions is what's called the differential or continuous entropy of a finite set of Gaussian random variables. So what's that all about? I have some Gaussian random variables that are correlated, and there's a covariance matrix C. And I define this function on principal submatrices. So think of this covariance matrix as having row and column indices that are the same. And if you pick a subset of those indices, say the indices are 1 through n, if I pick a subset of those indices, then that defines a principal submatrix. And if I look at the log of the determinant of that principal submatrix, that's a function, and that's a submodular function. And the fact that submodular has been published several times over the years by different authors, but it certainly dates back at least to the 70s, maybe probably earlier. It doesn't have, trivially, any of the other nice properties like monotonicity or symmetry, things like that. It seems to be its own special kind of submodular function. So why was I so interested in that problem? Well, it's related to this so-called maximum entropy sampling problem. So here I have these indices 1 through n, and they index random variables, y1 through yn, and assume they have some continuous density function, gn. Then the goal is to choose a subset of the indices, or of the random variables, of a certain size. So I want to pick s of the random variables. Think of n as much, much larger than s. And what I want to do is, I'm only going to get to observe the random variables indexed by s. But I want to get as much information about the entire vector of random variables as possible. So that's my goal, to pick a subset of a certain size, pick the best subset to get as much information, whatever that means, about the entire set of random variables. So that's the maximum entropy sampling problem. And this is the way information is usually measured. So you take the marginal density function, so this is the density on those random variables you're actually measuring. You evaluate it on this random vector, so that's a random quantity, and take the negative of the expected value of the log of that. Now, and it's a whole subject to understand why that's an interesting measure. The idea of it was originally put forth by Clausius, who was an Austrian engineer, I think. But he really didn't do much with it mathematically. It was really Boltzmann, when he laid the foundation of statistical mechanics, really put some mathematical meat to it. And then it's been used, you know, by these other names that you've heard of in other subjects. So partially I put all these names here because now I don't really need to justify the formula, because if these really smart guys used it, it must be a good formula. But it's a useful formula for all the reasons why any kind of definition is useful for us. It is related to something important, and it's easy. It has nice mathematical properties that we can exploit, so it strikes the right balance. Just to give you some idea, if you took a univariate random variable from some parametric family, and the parameter was the variance of that univariate family, like think about normal random variables with mean zero, higher values of the variance will correspond to higher values of the entropy. So somehow this is a way to measure how spread out the density function is, but it's not related directly related to the moments of the random variable. It's really using the whole density function in a certain way. So in any case, large entropy means very spread out. And so what you want to do is find a subset of the random variable that has high entropy. And that will allow you to infer as much information about the entire set as possible. You want to capture as much entropy in what you're observing. So zeroing in a little more on the application, it's environmental monitoring, where you have a bunch of environmental monitoring stations. So here there's, in North America, there's about 220 of these. I updated this recently. It's more like 240 or so now. They measure, so on a weekly basis, There are these very sophisticated, you'll see, devices that catch precipitation, and then it's analyzed for all kinds of things like sulfates. There's a whole list of things that they're analyzed for. Some are it's analyzed on a collected and analyzed on a daily basis, like mercury. There's a huge amount of free data available. You can go to this website and get all the data you want. And so there's something in the U.S. called the Clean Air Act of 1990, and it's been revised many times since. And that act mandates monitoring the effects of acid rain, not just where it's coming from. So it's not enough to just put sensors on the tops of smokestacks and see, you know, who's spewing out what, but you really need to see what the effects are. And so these stations are scattered all about. And the question we were asked originally was, suppose we don't have the money to operate all of them, we want to operate a subset of a certain size, which are the right ones to do the monitoring at? So this is just a little picture of, it's really not for you, it's, you know, for somebody who needs a little more help understanding what we're talking about with stuff going into the atmosphere and coming down in the rainwater. This I love. I mean, this is just priceless. Well, it's not priceless. It's about $5,000, and if you want to set up your own monitoring station, you first have to get one of these. It's about $5,000 fully loaded. So fully loaded, I could put you in this for maybe $4,800, Rob. So fully loaded means that it's fun to read the specs of this. If like there are three or four drops of rainwater, this thing will go into action. So go into action means this. There's this very sophisticated thing here called a bucket. And there's this thing over the top. And it's covered. And so if it's not raining, the thing is supposed to be closed. But then there's this stuff here that's a sensor. And when a couple of drops of rainwater hit, the thing opens up and starts collecting. And I guess you don't want to collect, you know, bird deposits and other things like that when it's not raining. So you have this kind of, you know, incredibly sophisticated, this uses, infrared sensors. You have this bucket. It's just really hilarious. But anyway, these things go out for bid. I mean, you should see the federal papers where they put out the specs that you have to satisfy, and these things go out for bid, and of course there's, you know, one bidder, and this is what they come up with. So I just want to show you what's been happening over the last 15 years or so. And so dark is bad, so this is bad. So bad for the environment, good for the economy. Here, 8 years later, economy is doing worse, acid rain doing better, and even better now. So I'm not really saying that it's totally related to the economy. But what I am saying is this. This is what I'm saying. People are watching, and that's a good thing. Okay? So having these networks and keeping track of these things and putting the data on the internet, so that you can see what's happening is a good thing. I'm not saying that any of the work I did actually caused things to get better. It's probably more the economy. But I think it's a good thing that people are trying to do this monitoring, do it in a cost-effective way, and getting the data out there publicly. That's my little say about that. The actually, I'll get back to that. One of these is Ithaca, New York. I think it's right there. Oh, 2008. Oh, one dark. Well, you even know that's Ohio. I mean, I'm just broadening my horizons to the little mitt there, but that's Ohio. I don't know. Anyway, it's all you get. I didn't make these pictures. You know, I wouldn't do that. I mean, you guys know me. But you can get even the pictures on the internet. So it's a great subject to work in. People prepare the data for you. They give you the pictures. All right. So back to the substance a little bit. So this function negative of the expected value of the of the log of the density function evaluated in the set of random variables is a submodular function. It's not exactly the entropy. So in the Gaussian case, I said we're going to look at the log of the determinant of the covariance matrix, and that's essentially the entropy. There's an absolute constant here, it's a half, and then there's an additive constant here that depends on the number of random variables. So if these are all fixed, maximizing this log determinant is equivalent to maximizing the entropy. A neat thing, and it's more than a neat thing, it's a useful thing. The Gaussian distribution maximizes the entropy for a fixed covariance matrix. Now, this just sounds like a nice kind of extremal result. It's just kind of fun and beautiful. But the kinds of methods we use to exactly solve problems are branch and bound methods. And in branch and bound, you look at subproblems and you get an upper bound on the subproblem. So we always assume that we have a Gaussian distribution. If you had a black box instead that gave you entropy values through whatever computational method you had, if you assume that that sample covariance matrix is coming from a Gaussian distribution, and you have an upper bound for the entropy for the Gaussian, that's an upper bound for the entropy for anything else. Okay, so the branch and bound method is still valid if you do calculate your bounds based on the Gaussian and calculate your function values based on any kind of method at all, a black box method. You would expect that in that sense that the if the random variables really are Gaussian, that this kind of method will perform better. Because the bounds are going to be the same, but maybe the actual values whatever they are for the Gaussian or lower. So that's an interesting fact, and I think useful. So it makes you feel a little less queasy about assuming a Gaussian distribution. There's this conditional additivity, and I kind of slipped this by, but this is the real justification for the objective function. Here's what I said our objective was: maximize the entropy, and we assume that we're going to constrain the number of elements we pick. This is what we really want to do. We want to minimize this quantity. So this is the conditional entropy. It's how much disorder is in the random variables that I don't observe conditioned on the ones I do observe. And that's really what we want to minimize. But because the system-wide entropy is constant, then minimizing that's the same as maximizing this. So in determinants, it's short complement. Everything, there's a lot of things that, if you just think matrix algebra, you know it all. So this is true in a more general sense, and not just true for the Gaussian, but that's right. Changing the coordinate system, this isn't so important because I'm not going to actually show you computational results, but the important thing to really look at is if I have a bound and a value for the objective value, I should really be looking at differences, not ratios. The ratio doesn't really mean anything. Differences are invariant under, say, scaling the random variables, and that's really what has some kind of intrinsic meaning. There's this, once you realize you're trying to maximize this determinant, you get, your paperback copies of Horn and Johnson, and you just are pouring through them and trying to find equations and inequalities you can use. And this is a great one. Let me read this. You can read it the way it stands. Let me read it to you entropy-wise. So this says that the entropy of this set indexed by S can be thought of as the system-wide entropy plus the entropy of the set you don't observe, but not for the same covariance matrix, for the inverse covariance matrix. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And again, it's not just interesting, you can find uses for it. If I can find an upper bounding method for this quantity, where the inputs to that upper bounding method would be the covariance matrix C and the number of random variables I'm choosing little s, I can apply that same method over here, and now my input would be n minus s, that's the number of random variables I'm choosing, but I use the inverse covariance matrix. So what I can do is take that bounding method, apply it to this quantity, and that implies an upper bound on that quantity, and it may not be the same depending on the upper bounding method. And most upper bounding methods I know are not invariant under this transformation. So whenever we come up with an upper bounding method, there's a good chance that we really came up with two upper bounding methods, and one may be better than the other. And often these kind of inverse methods are better for reasons I have no understanding of. So if we're really going to go down this path of trying to do branch and bound, we should first make sure the problem is hard enough to do branch and bound on. There shouldn't be a nice efficient algorithm. Yeah?
Is that the inverse of the submatrix or the submatrix of the inverse?
So it's a submatrix of the inverse. It's not so easy to actually prove that. Is it the same as the one above? No, I don't think so. Because this is always H. It's always based on, so that's the...
Yeah, conditional on S.
Oh, but conditional S. Yeah, you're right. That's right. Good point. So this is an NP-hard problem. I won't do the proof, but I'll tell you how to do the proof. So what you want to do to show something is hard is take a problem you know is hard and reduce it to your problem. So a hard problem is a special case of your problem, then your problem is hard. So the nice one to take is vertex packing in a graph. So I have a n-vertex graph, and I want to choose s vertices that have no edges between them. Maybe I want to pick three vertices out of these four, and what I want to do is pick vertices 1, 3, and 4. There's no edges between them, and that's an independent set of size 3. So what I want to do is model this vertex packing problem, this independent set problem, as an entropy problem. So what I do is I write down the vertex, the adjacency matrix of the graph. So that's what's here, except I put big numbers on the diagonal. And big means 3 times the number of vertices. And by putting enough on the diagonal, you order the subdeterminants in a certain way, so that the ones with very few entries off the diagonal have the biggest determinant. So the determinant of the red submatrix here corresponding to vertices 1, 3, 4 is just 12 to the power 3 because every other entry is 0. So it's just the diagonal matrix. You need to put that stuff on the diagonal to make that happen, that if I pull out a couple of ones, a symmetric pair of ones, that the determinant would increase. Increase if I pull them out. So you need to have that stuff on the diagonal. So that's how you set up the proof, and you have to actually go and prove it, that the determinants of this matrix that are as big as possible, the principal submatrix determinants, really are the ones that have nothing off diagonal. So it's a little something to prove. Okay, so if you want to do branch and bound, I'm going to keep forgetting to say all the players here. So that's Chun Ko and Maurice Kairon, who I started this work with a long time ago. We started trying to apply branch and bound methods. So you have to decide how you're going to branch. So branching means you either take a random variable and you say, I'm not going to look at it, or I'm going to observe that random variable. And so what that means for the covariance matrix, if I'm not going to observe something, I just strike out the row and column. That's easy enough. And if I'm going to force myself to observe it, then I do short complement. I condition on that random variable. And then I'll pick up the entropy of that random variable, the log determinant of that diagonal entry, and then I start to look at this conditional covariance matrix. So branching is fairly easy. So then the whole thing is bounding. And bounding, you need two kinds of bounds. You need lower bounds for maximization. That means good feasible solutions, like what the practitioners are doing, greedy algorithms, local search. And you need upper bounding methods. And that's what I've been spending a lot of time on with my friends. over, you know, roughly from 92 through, I don't know, maybe, well, we didn't talk about at lunch, but maybe at dinner. So there's two kinds of bounding methods, broadly speaking. There are ones based on eigenvalues, and there are ones based on nonlinear programming. Of course, you know, you can view eigenvalues as related to nonlinear programming too. But there's a whole bunch of other things that you can use to improve these eigenvalue-based bounds, including integer linear programming, Lagrangian relaxation, dynamic programming. So I'll show you some of that as we go. So most of what we're going to talk about now are methods to calculate upper bounds on the solution. So I mentioned this already. I'm not going to say this again. Using this equation, we can easily take bounds for the problem and apply it to this inverse problem and get another set of bounds. So that was something that was in this nonlinear programming approach paper with Kurt, Marcia, and Joy. Nice thing about nonlinear programming approaches is it's handling side constraints is straightforward. That's a huge advantage. So I'm thinking about 0-1 variables, so I'm going to relax because I'm looking for an upper bound. I want to solve a convex optimization problem. So I'm going to have variables between 0 and 1. You're going to think of those variables as picking out which random variables that I select for observation. So I have this cardinality constraint. I have maybe side constraints, budget constraints, who knows what. And then there's this objective function. So this is a continuous relaxation of the problem. And let me try to explain it a bit. So let's look at this function here. There's no sleight of hand. It's the same function. Nothing up my sleeve. So what I want to check is that if I evaluate this function on a 0-1 vector, I really get the entropy that would be associated with that set S that indexes the ones. And then if I maximize over the continuous set, maybe I get something bigger, so it's an upper bound. So there are these constants P and D, and just assume they're positive numbers. Let's not worry about how we pick them. Assume they're 1 if you want. So let's just try plugging in this indicator vector of the set S. So let's see what happens. If I plug in 1 for xj, I get dj, which we're assuming dj is 1. So I get 1 to the 1, that's 1, minus 1 times 1, so I get 0. So I turn 1 into 0. Similarly, if I plug in 0, I get d to the 0, which is 1, minus 0. So I get 1. So this function here simply turns 1 into 0 and 0 into 1. Now, you can think of simpler functions to do that, much simpler functions. But there's a reason to pick this particular one. So let's go on a little bit. So that part of the function is this over here. And now there's this part here. This part picks out a principal submatrix. So you just think about it. It's covariance matrix C. I take a square matrix where that's the diagonal, and I hit C on both sides, so I pick out that principal submatrix. Because I have all these extra zeros, and now you see why I want to add this in, because that's going to string ones down here, and now if I take the determinant of this, I'll really get the determinant of the principal submatrix. So the complementing is really just to put ones back over there. But as I said, you could do that in many ways. Instead of this crazy function here, you could just have 1 minus xj. That would do the trick as well. So the reason to put it in this form and have these powers and these constants is to make sure that this function is a concave function, because we're going to maximize it. And if we really want a bound, we need the global maximum, so we better make sure the global and local maxima are the same. And so there's some conditions that you can work out, you meaning Kurt, which will make sure that this is a nice concave function. So that's the reason for doing it. There's a lot more to this, and I would say it's still kind of unsolved in a way. So there's conditions that you can impose to make this a concave function. There's dominance, so you have some guidance about how to choose the P and the D to try to get the bound to be as small as possible, this upper bound. You can also observe that this entropy function can be scaled. So if I scale the matrix, what that does is I introduce the scaling constant. It's going to add the scale, log of the scaling constant times the size of the principal submatrix that we're looking at. It's going to add that. So if I subtract that back out, I can get a bound from this kind of function. And this is not invariant. The bound can change for different scaling parameters. You can try to come up with the best scaling parameter. You've got to still make sure things are concave. And so you can actually cast the problem of finding the right scaling parameter, keeping concavity as a semi-definite program. And so there's a lot you can do. You have to decide how much you're going to do, because this is all in the context of branch and bound. And it can be a lot of work to pick these things perfectly. So what I say is not completely solved is really what's the best choice of all these things. And I actually believe that something's very wrong here. There should be a nice bound that is invariant under complementing, invariant under scaling, just is nicer mathematically. And my guess is there's a better bound that has nicer mathematical properties, but maybe that's just because I'm a romantic. I'm not sure. But I mean, this is all correct, but I still think there's something that we're missing and there's more work to do here. So a completely different kind of bound. The first bounds that I looked at with Chun and Maurice were eigenvalue bounds. And so these come from very simple principles. So I'm trying to bound, forget logs now, I'm trying to bound the determinant of an S by S principal submatrix. The determinant of that principal submatrix is the product of its eigenvalues. But I can use eigenvalue interlacing, that the biggest eigenvalue of the whole matrix is an upper bound on the biggest eigenvalue of the optimal solution matrix. And the same is true for the second biggest and the third biggest. So why don't I just take the S biggest eigenvalues of the whole matrix, take their product, and that's an upper bound on the product of the S biggest eigenvalues of the S by S matrix, but that's its determinant. So that works wonderfully. If you put it back with the logs, I'm just saying take the S biggest eigenvalues of the whole matrix and sum up their logs, and that's an upper bound. You can deal with the nice thing about the nonlinear programming approach is side constraints sort of is clear. You just put them in the nonlinear program. Here, if I have very binding side constraints, that's not going to change the bound, so that's a bad thing. You wouldn't think that branch and bound would do too well if you had very binding side constraints. So you need to take advantage of those. And there's a way to do it using Lagrangian relaxation. So what I do is I have a penalty for every side constraint. The side constraints are, you know, AX less than or equal to B. And I cook up this kind of function here. So I use the same bound as before. I look at the sum of the logs of the eigenvalues, the S biggest eigenvalues. But it's not the original matrix. It's a scaled version of the matrix. And then I have this linear correction in these penalties. Now, the scaling is exactly this. It's something that's cooked up from the penalties and the constraint coefficients. And this smells a lot like what Lagrangian relaxation looks like for integer linear programming, this linear correction and you know, this kind of change, although it's quadratic in this kind of D matrix. Anyway, it's very easy to check that that's a upper bound for any non-negative pi on the entropy, that it's a convex function, and it's actually, as long as there's no tie for the critical eigenvalue, so what that means is for the S and S plus first largest eigenvalue of this matrix, if they're not equal, then this thing is as differentiable as you like. Otherwise, you know, you've got to talk to Adrian about how to get a get an actual descent. But we don't have a lot of time to talk to Adrian, and what I mean by that is we're doing branch and bound, and you know, we're looking at millions of subproblems, and this is going to get me the bound for one subproblem. So what I actually do in practice is I'm doing branch and bound. I calculate the bound just with the eigenvalues, forgetting the side constraints. And if I'm close, so if the upper bound is close to the best known solution that I have, then I go for it. And then I start trying to fathom by finding better penalties than all zero. So I take a few gradient steps. And if it looks like I'm getting close, I keep going. If I'm not getting close, I give up. So you do this when you feel like you have a shot at it. I said take gradient steps. How do you do that? Well, the notation here is that for each of these eigenvalues of that scaled matrix, there's an eigenvector, you know, scaled to have unit Euclidean norm. So I take these S eigenvectors, and I square their entries and add them up. And it's easy to check that that's a continuous solution, meaning that the numbers I get are between 0 and 1, and they add up to S. And if you take that solution and you plug it into the constraints, just like you would in integer linear programming, except you wouldn't cook it up this way, you get the gradient of this V function. There it is. So as long as there's no tie for the critical eigenvalue, you get the gradient. If there's a tie for other ones, then you have to be a little more careful here because it's not a one-to-one correspondence between the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. You have to find bases for eigenspaces, but spaces. But anyway, we're just trying to get bounds. So we do a few cheap steps like this. We don't do exact line searches, which is good because we don't want to get to local optima where there's going to be where this condition is not going to hold anymore. So we just want to do a few quick steps and see if we can fathom. So using available software, this works really well. Yeah. Ah, yeah. That's true too. So yeah, Mike was actually really thrilled that when he was telling me we were talking about gradient sampling, and then he got all excited about BFGS, and I told him that we were doing this years earlier using that code. He's using BFGS for a problem that's not differentiable, and it worked really well. And so that's the story he's been telling is BFGS works really well. So this is with some good ex post. Justification of that. And he actually also tried, our problem, trying to really exactly minimize for smaller ones, and we were really interested in using gradient sampling when there are these ties, because there are always these ties. In that picture, there wasn't a tie. There's no non-differentiability right at the bottom there, but often on real problems, there are ties. Okay, so you can do even better using an idea of partitioning. This is a typo there, sorry. Joy Williams and Alan Hoffman. So this is a really simple idea. If I have a system of random variables, and I think about the entropy of the whole set, an upper bound on that is what I can do is I can partition those random variables into sets. Just let's say two sets. And I pretend there's no covariance, there's no interaction between the two sets. So I look at one set in isolation and then another set in isolation. Okay, so all of a sudden one set isn't telling me anything about the other set. So I'm just saying take the covariance matrix, make some blocking of it, and zero out these entries. So what you've done is you've added more disorder to the system. Now maybe these random variables told you everything about these, now they're telling you nothing. So what can happen for a principal submatrix is that the determinant will go up, probably, or stay the same. So for any solution, any feasible solution, the objective value will stay the same, the entropy, or it will increase. But the bound might decrease. Okay, so that's counterintuitive. So I can take a partitioning of this matrix like that, this block, just throw some zeros in this very defined way, and calculate the upper bound, and even though the objective value can't go down, the bound might go down, which means the bounds aren't so good probably. But so now you can take advantage of this by trying to find a good partitioning. So one thing you can do is take this really trivial partitioning into singletons. So then all you're doing is you're zeroing out everything except the diagonal, and then the S biggest eigenvalues are the S largest diagonal entries. And it's kind of interesting that it took us years to realize that that's an upper bound on the entropy too, just the product of the S biggest diagonal entries. Why look at the S biggest eigenvalues? But somehow, we wanted to, something genetic about looking for eigenvalues, and we didn't think of that. So if you take, the block, one block, that's this ordinary eigenvalue bound. If you take singletons, then it's the diagonal bound. But you can try all different kinds of partitionings. Basically what we do in the code is we do local search in the space of partitions and try to find good partitions. And that's pretty effective. Now, once you start thinking about that, you can, again, try to take a bound and squeeze a little more out of it. So say I have some partitioning of the matrix like this, so some blocks, and I zero everything else out. You know, think about what a solution looks like. It's going to pick a certain number of elements from each of the blocks. Now, when I think about, like a 2x2 block, why on earth would I start calculating eigenvalues of a 2x2 matrix? I know exactly what the optimal value is for picking 0, 1, or 2 elements from a 2x2 block. I can just check. So what this tries to do is, when you have a partitioning and a bound, squeeze it a little more by doing better with the small blocks and the very large blocks. And so think about what's going on here. So xki is 1 if I pick k elements from block ni. So these blocks are named, they're indexed. What I want to do is for each block, I want to pick a certain number of elements from it. 1 element, 2 elements, 3 elements, no elements at all. So there's no x0i. And I want to make sure that I pick s elements altogether. And I charge myself k for every time I pick k elements from block I. So the whole thing is really what I put in the objective. I mean, this is all kind of trivial. So in the objective, I have sk of ni. So that's the value or an upper bound on picking k elements from block ni. So if block ni is really small, I calculate the optimal value. And if it's large, I do the eigenvalue bound, or I do the complementary eigenvalue bound, any bound I want. So in this way, you can improve on the bound from a partitioning. And this is very practical, because the size of the problem that's interesting here are picking from 100 or 200 points. And so, the size of these integer problems isn't so big compared to, trying to solve big linear objective combinatorial optimization problems. So this ends up being quite effective. Let's see, what else? You can use integer programming, but you can also do this with dynamic programming. And think about, what's going on here. This is really a very simple structure here. And so you can do dynamic programming to optimize this. And, so I'm trying to use every discrete optimization technique known to mankind. If the blocks are small, think about what you need to do. You need to pick 0, 1, or 2 elements. When things go up to 2, you should ask yourself, is it a matching problem? And you can write this as a matching problem, and so there's a polynomial time algorithm. So drifting back to the continuous, there's another way to gain something from partitioning if you try to think about a continuous analog of partitioning. So one way to think about what we were doing is I take the covariance matrix and I look at the Hadamard product of it with a matrix that looks like this. Blocks of ones on the diagonal and zeros off. If I take the Hadamard product of that with my covariance matrix, then I get what I was talking about. Well, does the matrix really have to look like this, or does everything I was doing work for something more general? So actually, if you take any matrix in the elliptope where the diagonal is 1 and it's positive semi-definite, and do the same thing, Hadamard product and then this eigenvalue bound, that's an upper bound. So now you can try to find the best matrix in the elliptope in terms of trying to minimize this bound now. Now, this is a big, hairy problem. It's not differentiable, it's not convex, but it's kind of a fun problem. And again, you don't really need to globally optimize this. What you want to do is try to get a good solution quickly so that you can fathom and branch and bound. So maybe I'm just going to skip the justification of why that works, because I want to get to something else. But so Kurt and I worked on that continuous version of these spectral bounds, and I did more work on this with Sam Buehrer. If you want to read more about this, there's an article in the Encyclopedia of Environmetrics. It's coming out. The second edition is coming out in 2011, so there's an update on this. I agreed to do this because I thought it's obvious. They'll give me a copy of this, massive volume. No, authors don't get copies. Whatever. They did agree to give me a copy of my article. That's very generous. And there's some other places you can look for kind of surveys of this. So there's say 15 minutes left. So I want to talk about the computer science approach to this problem. So there's a chance to jump back in, especially if you don't like matrices. Who doesn't like matrices? Almost everybody here has authored a paper about Matroid, so I know I'm beating an old horse for you guys. But let me remind you what a Matroid is. So a Matroid M has a finite ground set, and subset of the power set of N, so a set of subsets of the ground set that have these simple properties. So the set of subsets is called the set of independent sets. And the properties are simple. It says that if I have an independent set, then every subset of it should be independent. And then the other property is if I have two independent sets, one bigger than the other, there should be an element that I take, should always be an element that I can take from the bigger and put in the smaller and stay independent. And so if you think about columns of a matrix, say, and linear independence, this is obvious. If you think about acyclic sets of edges of a graph, it's also pretty obvious, less obvious to the more continuous. It's actually a good litmus test, whether you're in your heart, you're a continuous person or a discrete person. So if that's obvious to you, you're a discrete person. But paradoxically, the case of graphs is a special case of the matrix case. So every discrete person really is a continuous person. It's interesting. There's lots of examples. So I mentioned these two, graphic and linear. But there's many more examples, really simple examples of picking no more than r elements from a finite set on n elements, taking direct sums. There's some pretty complicated examples having to do with picking a finite field and a subfield and looking at algebraic independence relative to the subfield. And there's sort of more combinatorial constructions involving duals and linking systems, something that was kind of repopularized recently. So there's lots of examples of these things. Here's the constrained submodular maximization problem. So what I'm going to talk about doesn't just pertain to maximum entropy sampling. Maximizing any submodular function where the function is given to you by a black box and an oracle in Matroid speak. I have a collection of subsets of this finite ground set, and what I want to do is maximize this submodular function, but the feasible sets have to be in F. So F might be the set of independent sets of a matroid, or it might be feasible solutions of a knapsack constraint. Okay, those are the two that we have results for. So it's NP-hard, even without the side constraints, because the maximum cut problem is a special case of it. We showed the entropy problem is a hard case. So the computer science view is okay. It's hard. We don't want to solve problems. We want to prove things about algorithms. So we'll look for approximation algorithms. So we look for heuristics that have performance guarantees. So what we can show is for k-knapsack constraints, you can always get within about a fifth of the optimal value for k-fixed. And I'm going to actually show you this, what sounds more complicated, but the proof is more approachable, of when there are k-matroid constraints. So it means I have k-matroids on the ground set, k could be 1, and I want to maximize the submodular function, but the set that I pick has to be independent in these k-matroids. So if you want something concrete, you have a linear matroid, and so that means that the ground set of the submodular function is the column labels of a matrix, and I want to maximize this submodular function, but this extra side constraint that the columns that I pick have to be linearly independent. So when k is 1 or 2, this is classical for linear objectives, and there's a polynomial time algorithm. So you can think of this as an effort to try to look at nonlinear objective combinatorial optimization problems where you know how to solve the linear case when k is 1 or 2 and you want to see what you can do for the hard nonlinear cases. So again, I'm going to concentrate on matroids. I have very little time. So I'm going to show you a very simple local search procedure and show you how to tweak that a little bit to get something where you can prove that you get within this constant factor for fixed k. Okay, here's the local search, really simple. So I have a solution. It's supposed to be independent in these k matroids, and I'm trying to get a big value for the submodular function f. So what do I allow? I allow local moves where I can delete an element. Now, when I delete an element, that keeps me feasible in the matroids because subsets of independent sets are independent. It might increase the function because I don't assume monotonicity of f. And the other thing I allow myself to do is add an element. But if I add an element, I might get into k bits of trouble because I have k matroids. And when you throw an element into an independent set, you either stay independent or you get a unique dependent set. And removing any element from that dependent set will break that dependent set, the matroid property. So I might get into trouble in all k matroids separately and have to delete k elements when I throw an element in. So in a way, those are the simplest. You can't just allow deletion. You're going to throw everything away. You have to be able to grow. So this allows you to grow as well. You can add an element. You might have to delete up to k elements, but maybe you don't. Maybe you add the element for free, and you don't have to delete anything. So this allows you to go up and down in the simplest possible way. And what you can show is that if S is locally optimum with respect to this local search, and C is any solution, but think about it as the optimal solution, then you have this kind of inequality. And so you want to think of this as a lower bound on F of S, okay? But what you really want is the optimal objective value here, and you've got something a little more complicated. So that's where you're going to lose something in the proof. So I'll outline the proof later. Later can't be too much later. But you use submodularity and matroid exchange properties. So I just want to convince you that that algorithm isn't good enough. And so think about the example of submodular functions related to directed graphs. So I have the solution here of these points. And I'm thinking about the edges that leave as the value of the function. And blue is supposed to be a lot lighter than red. It's blue is weight 1, but red has weight m. So here I have this solution. It's got a paltry value of 4. And here's this great solution over here with value 4m. So it's much, much better. But I can't get there. If I say I have no side constraints, k equals 0, what am I allowed to do? I'm allowed to delete. Or I'm allowed to, what am I allowed to do? I'm allowed to add an element. That's all I'm allowed to do. And I can take this element and I can get rid of it, but now I lose one. This blue edge isn't leaving anymore. Or I can take an element over here and I can throw it in, but now also I lose that one. What I really want to do is swap these two. But when k equals 0, that's not allowed. So I'm stuck with this kind of local search, and it's a terrible gap. So there's a way to fix that, and it's by iterated local search. This is a kind of a standard trick in this area. So what I'm going to do is do local search, get a solution. Maybe it's good, maybe it's not. And then think about that example. The problem in that example was this great solution that was completely disjoint from my local solution. So what I'm going to do is do local search again on the remaining set, and I'm actually going to iterate this several times, k times, and take the best of all these. So I'd say here, just do it twice and take the best, and you can prove that gets you within a constant factor. Here's a proof of that. Let me just, I don't know. Let's just see the kind of, maybe I'll try to do this at a high level. So you have the optimal solution C, and this is your locally optimal solution over the whole ground set. And then T is the locally optimal solution over the part that's disjoint from S. So I have these two local solutions. I want to compare their value to C and show that at least one of them has a pretty good value. So local optimality, if I ever prove this lemma here, this lemma, which I haven't proven, gives you that inequality and that inequality. And if I add them together and then use the fact that k is at least 1 and non-negativity and submodularity twice, so again, I'm not going to do it, but if you apply submodularity to those two sets and then those two sets, you get it. So what do you get? You get that this is at least that, and now you really have what you want. That means that If you bring the k plus 1 over, then at least one of these sets has to be at least half of what you get on the right-hand side. So, I mean, you can believe that the steps are correct, and that's the kind of proof that you get. So in a way, it's not conceptually hard. I mean, if you have a lot of intuition, you come to this proof quickly. If you don't, and you're just tenacious, and you just keep playing with all the inequalities, you'll get it anyway. It'll just take you longer. So anyway, as I said, you do this a bunch of times. I said k, you actually do k plus 1 times and take the best, and then you can prove it's more details that you get within this factor. Where are the matroids? So that's been hidden. So let me just quickly tell you where the matroids are hiding. So if I have two independent sets and say they have the same size, there's always a labeling of the element. You take the elements that are in one set but not the other on both sides, so the symmetric difference. What you know is you can exchange those two sets and get, you have a set that's independent, set that's independent. If you exchange them, you get independent. So there's always a labeling, though, so that you can pairwise do these exchanges and keep independence. So that's used you can find this in Shriver's book, or you can find anything in that book. It's thousands of pages. But it's used for all the basic algorithms in matroid optimization. And so once you know you're independent here and use local optimality to see that you have this inequality, and now that's all the matroids you need. Now you just take all these inequalities and you apply submodularity a bunch of times and you get what you want. You get this lemma. Really, the matroid part just gets used in this one spot here. But it's kind of a powerful idea. So there's an unfortunate detail in that this is a great algorithm. It gets you this factor, wherever it is. I don't know, somewhere. I don't know. There it is. So it gets you this factor, but it doesn't do it in polynomial time. So it might be that this takes too many steps. So the way to get polynomial time is to you have to sacrifice a little bit in the approximation ratio and do things approximately. So in nonlinear programming, this makes perfect sense. Once you stop getting good increases, you stop. So I only accept an increase if it gets me, at least this factor better than the previous solution. It's the same factor in both places. That turns out to get me an epsilon version of this lemma, and just trace all the proofs through, and everything still works. So for any fixed epsilon, you'll get within this factor, and the factor just suffers by an epsilon. But the running time is bad in epsilon, or 1 over epsilon. Anyway, you can do even better. So we were just adding one element. You can actually add p elements and delete up to k times p elements. Right? You might get into trouble for each of those elements in each of the matroids. You might delete kp elements. This p can depend on the epsilon. And so if you play with all these parameters, you can do even better. And you can get within a factor of 1 over k plus epsilon, which improves 1 over k plus 1 that Fisher, Nemhaus, and Woolsey got a long time ago. So we turn the 1 into an epsilon, and that's epsilon can be very small compared to 1. And you can get more out of it, but I mean, these are the main ideas that I wanted to talk about, and that is it.